I basically was laying on a ledge, feeling my blood fill up my chest cavity, and feeling my breath get shorter and shorter, knowing that if the helicopter didn't get there, that I was going to die. But I really had this thought, like, okay, well, if I die today, how do I feel about my life? Like, if this is it, what do you think? What's the scorecard? How did you do? You know, one of the things I thought, well, if I, you know, I can be happy about my climbing career. I didn't do everything I wanted to do, but I did a lot of things that I wanted to do. I'm really proud of what I accomplished in climbing. But one of the things I hadn't done that I was really aware of is I hadn't done anything that helped others or helped my community or passed on information or become a teacher. You know, I think that these accidents often become these sort of crucible moments in our lives where we kind of makes you sit down and be like, okay, what do I want to do?
Welcome to the Stopecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it. What's up, Stokecasters? It's Jonathan Ronzio, Emily Holland here, back with another episode. This one is special. This is our first two-part episode. We had such a good conversation with our guests here, and I say guests because it's both Steve House and Scott Johnston, the co-authors of Training for the Uphill Athlete, and you may also know Training for the New Alpinism. But these guys, climbers, coaches, authors, really fantastic. This new book of theirs, The Uphill Athlete, is really the manual for mountain running and ski mountaineering. And we dig into everything from training and exercising to physiological and all that you need to know when you're thinking about planning and preparing it for your big mountain dreams and pursuits. But yeah, Emily, why don't you explain a little bit more about this two-parter here?
Yeah, so Jonathan and I were doing our regular intro-outro situation for interviews and realized that in the outro, quote-unquote, that we were doing around our mountain pursuits, we got really deep into detail and we had kind of a lengthier conversation. And we thought it would be a good idea to kind of split it up because Scott and Steve also give us a little bit of tips and tricks for those mountain pursuits during the interview. So you'll hear most of the interview today, and then next week we'll have the remainder of the interview and then get into Jonathan and I's mountain pursuits and how they went, things we learned, things along those lines. So we're looking forward to it and obviously always open to feedback and hope you guys enjoy.
So dig right in to this episode with Steve and Scott, and then stay tuned next week as we chat about Emily's first 50K and my rapid ascent of Pico de Orizaba. All right, Stokecast, what an exciting show for you today. We actually have the authors of Training for the Uphill Athlete and Training for the New Alpinism, the founders of uphillathlete.com, on to chat about all things mountain running, ski mountaineering, endurance, sports in the mountains. Really stoked for this conversation. This is Steve House and Scott Johnston. How you guys doing? What's up?
Hey, we're doing good.
Yeah, great day. Thanks for calling us and thanks for getting this organized.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're excited to have this conversation. So, you know, before we hit record, you mentioned that you're in the same house, but in separate rooms. Where are you guys? Give us a little context to what's going on.
Well, we're in the little enclave in the North Cass Mountains called Mazama, which is most people wouldn't consider a town. It's more of a hamlet. There's 250 full-time residents. We're right at the base of Washington Pass, which has some of the better alpine rock climbs in North America, and we're just outside the boundaries of North Cascades National Park, which is sort of some of the best real alpine mountaineering and mountain climbing in the U.S. So we're really in the heart of that area. And Steve and I actually met here over 20 years ago, and he lived here for a number of years, but I'm still living here. And so Steve is here for a visit and to do some more climbing.
All right. So, Steve, where did you go and why? Why'd you leave the Cascades there?
Well, that really involves a breakup story. I don't know if we want to go there. But, yeah, no, it's a great community. And I left here back in 2004 or 5 or something. Moved down to Central Oregon for a while, which is where I learned to rock climb and near where I grew up. And lived outside of Smith Rock for a while. Now I live in Ridgeway, Colorado, which is a great, great area as well, Southwest Colorado.
Awesome. Well, you guys, so this is an interesting interview because you obviously are both working together, have a business together, have written books together, but you also have not storied pasts. That's not the word I want, but both have impressive resumes and backgrounds. That's a better way of saying it. So we'd love to hear kind of how, I mean, you guys both grew up in really mountainous communities. Scott, you grew up in, from what we heard before we recorded, Boulder, and Steve in Oregon, it sounds like. So, you know, how did this love of the outdoors and love of the big mountains start for you?
Steve, why don't you go?
Okay, I'll start off with that. I grew up, you know, with a family that was just really active doing outdoor stuff. I mean, I have a, you know, both my parents, you know, went rock climbing back in the late 60s as one of their first dates. You know, like it was something that my dad actually picked up on a stint in the Army stationed in Stuttgart back in the mid 60s. He was a welder attached to a tank battalion, and he had a friend there in the Army that wanted a climbing partner to go do some climbs in the Alps. So he asked my dad. My dad was like, "Oh, that sounds cool." And this guy sort of taught my dad, and I ended up buying an old Volkswagen bus, and they would go every weekend, and every time they had a leave, they'd go down to the Alps and go climbing. And he came back with a love of just sort of climbing, mountaineering of all kinds. I would call it more like mountaineering. You know, so when I was born in Washington State, grew up in Oregon. So, you know, he would go like once a year and go like climb Rainier with a friend or go climb Mount Hood or something like that. And the same as far as how I grew up doing it, you know, it was the same. It was like something we did once or twice a year, but we also went hunting, we went fishing, we went backpacking, we went for day hikes, we went downhill skiing, we went cross country skiing, we went winter camping. Like climbing itself wasn't anything particularly elevated in my childhood. It was just something that part of the menu, what we did. And sometime in my late teens, I kind of got more into it for, I'm not really sure why, I just kind of liked it and started doing more rock climbing particularly. And then the kind of turning point for my life was that I went to Slovenia as an exchange student in 1988, the year after I graduated from high school. And I got there, and I'd been there for about 2 months and wasn't really finding my community. Back then, you know, obviously sort of pre-internet era, like I had been dropped into this society where I didn't speak the language. I was supposed to go to school, but obviously like listening to, you know, class, high school lessons in a language which I understood nothing of, was challenging. And started thinking about what I like to do and how to find a community there. And I thought, well, you know, I like to do mountain stuff. Like, where's the mountain community? So my host family helped me find the local climbing and mountaineering club. And that was it for me. Like, I walked in there that night, and 2 days later, I was climbing with a guy who turned out to be a lifelong friend. I was climbing with him just a few months, about 7 months ago, we were climbing together last. You know, that year I stopped going to school entirely, as is completely logical. And I think I climbed over 180 days that year. I just climbed more or less every day I could. And I totally got the bug. And we did every kind of climbing. We did sport climbing, rock climbing, ice climbing, mountaineering, like technical alpine climbing, like, you know, big winter ascents of like big, you know, 9,000 foot alpine rock walls in winter, all kinds of different stuff. We did ski touring. I did all kinds of stuff that year, and I came back from that and was totally hooked on sort of the mountain alpine climbing life. Pretty different than Scott's story, actually, who it's almost opposite, I would say.
Well, that's often the best way to come at a business relationship or any kind of creative pursuit, right? Is kind of varied backgrounds to approach things with different perspectives, but a similarity in the passion and drive and end goal, right?
Yeah, for sure. We were definitely, you know, Steve and I shared a lot of commonality in our experiences when we met, and we became good friends pretty quickly and did quite a lot of climbing together before we had, long before we had any sort of real business relationship. But my background was, as Emily said, growing up in Boulder, Colorado in the 60s, which was a fairly rebellious time. And at that point, you really couldn't do much more rebellious and counterculture and out of the mainstream than rock climbing. And so I viewed it, as a way to sort of rebel in a nonviolent way against my parents and that sort of thing. Because unlike Steve's parents, my parents' idea of being outdoors was be on the back porch with a beer and a cigarette. And so I didn't have that same kind of exposure. And so I was really drawn, to the freedom, and again that just that rebelliousness. I think it's teenage boys looking for some kind of pathway to manhood and something that's their own and different than perhaps what their parents want them to do. And at that time, and all through my youth and college, I was also involved in a really traditional sport of swimming, and I was swimming at quite a high level. I was involved in an Olympic development program in Colorado Springs, where I spent much of my time living in a dormitory and training 5 hours a day. So I had this very regimented aspect of my life, and climbing represented this complete freedom and no structure, no schedule. You just did your own thing. And so that was part of the appeal to me to get involved in climbing when I was in high school.
Well, so that, quite different backgrounds for sure, but both incredibly impressive. But I know, Steve, you went down the path of becoming this world renowned climber, putting up first ascents on some epic faces and mountains, and then as a mountain guide and an ambassador for different brands, and like so many of the natural progression of the top athletes we talk to. But and then Scott, I know you went from this competitive ski career to an aerospace engineer. Is that true?
Yes. So I partway through my collegiate swimming, I went to the University of Colorado on a swimming scholarship. And partway through it, it was interesting, in an interesting kind of one of those serendipitous sort of situations. The cross-country ski team shared the locker room with the swimmers. And at that time, virtually all the cross-country skiers were imports from Norway that were skiing for the team. And I met these guys and struck up a conversation with them. They took me out skiing, and I'd done some skiing when I was a kid. My uncle was a ski jumping coach, and all the kids in the family were forced to be ski jumpers. And so I had done some jumping, but I'd never really cross country skied. And these guys took me out and showed me how to cross country ski. And I just went, oh my God, this is so much more fun than staring at the bottom of a pool for 5 hours a day. And I quit in the middle of my swimming career. And and I launched into this cross country skiing thing. And I, luckily for me, I had some really good mentors in these young Norwegian guys. I followed them around, learned a lot. And I developed fairly quickly and moved on to have a moderately successful cross country ski career. Did some racing on the World Cup, and while I was going through school, I got a degree in mechanical engineering and one in mathematics. And after that, I did do a stint in a conventional aerospace business because I had a pretty serious climbing accident within a few weeks of graduating from college. I had a bad fall in Alaska and was laid up for quite a long time, and ended up needing to repay some medical bill debts and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, I'd never really planned on being an engineer, but might as well use my education. And so I went to work for an aerospace firm I didn't fit in particularly well, but I had promised my father I would stay a year to give it a try, and I lasted 1 year and 1 day. And that I then formed a company with one of my ex-professors, and we were involved in kind of the astronomical field, and we built large telescopes and developed a software system that drove these telescopes, and I did that for a number of years. And I was still cross-country ski racing at that time at a pretty high level. So it's a little bit of an unusual background, I suppose, kind of a hodgepodge. And I was still climbing during all this. You know, as you can see, I didn't have the focus that Steve had. I was kind of scattered doing different things.
You know, I feel you though. I'm so much the same way. I feel like I can't focus on one thing. I have to be doing a bunch of different things to be happy. But I do want to pick out one thing that you said where you tried cross-country skiing and you thought, wow, this is so much more fun than staring at the pool. But, you know, I went cross-country skiing back in February for the first time, skate skiing out in Whistler. And I loved it, but man, that's freaking hard. That is a crazy workout, right? So like, I think I want to figure out what it is about you that like, I think the majority of people look at a mountain and they're like, well, the chairlift is better than those idiots that are walking up the hill. And, or they like are into mountain biking, but they prefer downhill versus cross country, right? So like, a lot of people might say, you know what, I'd rather just go down this and hit this jump and flip into the pool all day. That sounds fun. Whereas you think of fun as, you know, something that works you mentally and physically way harder. So I want to learn what that's about.
Well, I think there's certainly a difference between people who are drawn to endurance sports seem to be, in my experience, they fit really well into that type A personality category where, you know, the more and harder things are or the more challenging things are, the more they enjoy them. Not that, you know, flipping into a pool or off of a ski jump is not challenging in its own way. But I think we tend to, those of us that are drawn to, you know, these longer duration, whether, you know, that's going uphill rather than taking, you know, hiking uphill or skiing uphill rather than using the chairlift, tend to have sort of embrace the whole process perhaps a little more in terms of like, it's the suffering, it's the learning, it's the experience of doing this that's as much the reward as anything else. And I think Steve and I certainly preach that with a lot of the clients we work with, how if you can't embrace the process, then you're never going to be able to succeed at these types of goals, like climbing big mountains or cross-country skiing or running in the mountains or whatever it is, because the set of skills and the physical capacities that it takes to do well at those things take, you know, hundreds or thousands of hours to develop. And so during that time, you may kind of suck at what you're doing until you get better. Like you probably found when you're cross country skiing, you went, oh, I kind of suck at this. And so you have to go, well, this is cool that I suck at this. I really want to get better, and I'm going to love the process of learning and becoming better. And if you can't embrace that process, then you'll very quickly get frustrated and, you know, fall out of the habit of wanting to do it.
That's super interesting. I think there's like a really clear lineage between you two. And first, I want to go back to Steve for just a curiosity question. So why Slovenia? You didn't speak the language, and you were taking classes in the language. Like, what brought you to that place? I'm just interested to hear about that.
Yeah, well, the answer is disappointingly simple. I didn't have a choice. So it was an American Field Service exchange, and you could ask for your preferred countries, and I asked for Switzerland, France, and Italy. And then Slovenia was actually part of Yugoslavia at that time. Mm. So I was in Yugoslavia. I literally didn't know where Yugoslavia was when I was told I could go there. And the way it worked is they say, okay, here's a family. And you basically have like a one pager on this family. Like, it's like, okay, this is like this chemical engineer and a civil engineer, the husband and wife, and then these two kids, and here's their ages and here's their names. And you get some basic information and know what their town is, where they live, and that's it. And it's either take it or leave it. So either go or you just pass. And then I could have gone on, you know, I'd been accepted to university up in Olympia, Washington. And so those were my choices. And I thought, you know, I really want to do this. I really don't want to go to university yet. And I want to check out some of the world and stuff. And so it was definitely a big gamble. I didn't take climbing or skiing stuff with me. I didn't, like, again, I mean, not to harp on this, but sort of pre-internet, basically I went to the library. There was no book on Yugoslavia. I just got this book about the world that had, like, you know, those books that have like two pages about every country in the world, right? And actually it had nothing to do with Slovenia. It was actually mostly about, you know, the capital and, you know, what the gross national product is and those kinds of things, right? Like, that in terms of like going there and living have no bearing whatsoever. And, you know, it was actually a really super interesting time. It was, you know, Yugoslavia, I think, was actually one of the more successful socialism experiments. People were really comfortable there. They didn't live particularly high on the hog, let's say, but they lived quite well in the sense of their quality of life was really good. They had a lot of time for things like climbing. They had a lot of time for family. You know, they didn't make much money, but as long as they stayed within their own economy, it was basically fine. Slovenia was the richest part of Yugoslavia because they are right on the border with Austria, and to a certain extent with Italy as well. And so that was kind of where most of the trade would go through. Most of the export businesses were there, which tended to be more profitable. So, you know, it was actually a really, and it's still Slovenia. If anyone is curious to go there, I absolutely recommend it. Now it's like traveling in Sweden. Like, everyone speaks perfect English, probably better than I do. back then, that wasn't the case because in 1988, that people learned German because they were doing trade with Austria and Germany, and nobody bothered to learn English. It wasn't quite the, you know, international language and is now. So I did find a couple of people that spoke English, and I did actually learn to speak the language reasonably well and can still hold conversations, and especially about climbing and skiing in Slovene. And I still have really close friends. And as luck would have it, my wife is from a town in Austria that's 30 minutes from the Slovenian border, and we go back to visit every year, and I can, you know, drive half an hour and I'm back in Slovenia, and I feel totally like I'm coming home. I go back all the time. I was there last summer for 3 months. So it's still a major part of my life.
That's incredible. I was just thinking, like, wow, that's a very interesting choice, but it makes much more sense now. Now that you lay it out like that. But I think the thing that I'm hearing and noting from both of your stories and backgrounds is that you took kind of like a hard right turn when people probably expected a certain path of you, right? So, Scott, you were doing the swimming thing very competitively, and then you're like, no, actually, I just want to do cross-country skiing. And Steve, you're like, well, I could go to college, I guess, or I could just go and live in this country that probably many of people around me are not as familiar with in that time. So I'd love to hear about when you guys met and what the kind of or if there was kind of a kindred spirit connection that you had.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, as Scott mentioned, we met here in Mazama, and like with a lot of my good friends, we met through a climbing partner, a mutual climbing partner. A friend of ours, Sean, had us both over for dinner one night and kind of introduced us. Scott had moved up here to the Metau. I think I'd been living here about 2 years at that time. And as Scott said, it's a really small place, only a couple hundred people. So, you know, good climbing partners are hard to find even in a big population base. You got that small of a population base, they're really valuable. And we just sort of started climbing and backcountry skiing together more or less right away. And, you know, I had quite a bit of free time as a mountain guide, like kind of doing seasonal work. I'd work in the summers and the winters, and I had, you know, 6 or 7 months of the year basically off. And Scott had recently sold a business and had more time, so he was available too. And you know, we got along really well and had interesting conversations about things other than climbing, for example. As you know, Scott's kind of a bit of a polymath, I would say. You know, it was about a lot of different subjects, and so we would always have interesting conversations. And I think that was also an important part of our friendship, is just exploring ideas and having discussions about everything from economics to religion to, you know, training. We talked about all of it.
It's kind of a beautiful thing about the climbing community or the outdoor community in general. It's just you find these people that you not maybe immediately click with for the actual sport, but then you find out all these, also you just are put in these situations that you have to, or you don't have to, but you are more apt to have these like deeper conversations because you've, you know, been through such physical trials together that, you know, the emotional or the like interesting other topics don't seem as scary as maybe a new person or a new stranger on the street that's not your climbing partner.
You know, everybody's unique and has their own stories and interests and backgrounds and ups and downs, but there's something about the outdoor pursuits that lays like a baseline of just commonality and interest that is so easy to just relate with other people who pursue the exact, you know, who are also passionate about the mountains, the outdoors, running, climbing, skiing, whatever it might be. You just generally find a lot of like-minded people in our space, and then it leads to those additional conversations, right? That are, you know, you're not just out there hiking, talking about hiking, and that's cool.
Yeah, that's for sure. And we did have a lot of conversations when we first started climbing together, and Steve was, you know, I as I said, kind of always a dabbler, and I might have dabbled at a high level, but I was still a bit of a dabbler in all these different things. And whereas Steve was really driven and focused and became apparent, you know, early on in our relationship, and that, you know, he was on this ascendant path with this, you know, very, very high aspirations. And he began to query me about training ideas. And I was coaching at that time. I was coaching a team of young cross-country skiers. And so he began to pester me with questions about, you know, how to train for this and that. And before too long, that these casual conversations kind of morphed into a coach-athlete relationship. And that really started kind of in earnest around, I think, 2001 would be roughly about the time I started acting, you know, as much as like sort of an advisor and consultant with Steve on his training. And we began to work more closely together. And then it blossomed, certainly during the heyday of Steve's climbing career over the next 6 or 7 years, where he achieved some of the most notable climbs that he did.
So would you say Steve was the original uphill athlete that you trained?
For sure. Yes. He was definitely the original one.
Well, that's awesome, guys. So I'm curious, like when in this relationship, you know, throughout the years of this kind of friendship and climbing partnership that evolved into coach athlete situation, and then when did it evolve into co-authors? Like, when did you guys start thinking, like, this thing that we've been doing and all this advice that I've been giving you and the feedback you've been giving me and the application in the real world and all the insights that we're learning here, we need to be sharing it with others. When did that kind of come about?
Well, I published a book in 2009 called Beyond the Mountain, and I did a little book tour with that. It's just basically a book of climbing stories, you know, centered around my climb of Nanga Parbat, which is probably the most famous ascent I've done. And every time when I would do the Q&A, the first question out of the gate was always, what do you do for training? And at first, I didn't know what to say because I realized people wanted the sort of easy answer. They wanted to say, oh, I run in the mountains or I climb a lot or whatever. But at this point, I've been working with Scott for 9 years. So my honest answer, I like to give honest answers. And my honest answer became, well, I could tell you, but I'd have to write another book. And I remember Scott and I were having one of our conversations actually on Skype, and he was in Norway with some skiers. And I was like, you know, relating the story to him and saying, you know, maybe we ought to write this stuff down. And we sort of joked like, yeah, well, you know, we'd write it. It'd be 100 pages. We'd run off you know, 200 copies at Kinko's and pass them out to all our friends, and that would be that. And it kind of never went on from there until about a year and a half later. I had a bad climbing accident, March 2010, and really serious accident where I was almost killed. Fortunately, you know, due to a helicopter and some bravery on the part and skill on the part of Parks Canada, I was rescued from the north face of Mount Temple. And then a few months after that, I was basically, you know, in the middle of a really long rehabilitation that was going to take at least months, if not a couple of years. And I said to Scott, like, I think we need to write that book, partly because I just need something to do. Like, I'm going to go crazy. I can't, you know, I was a professional climber, and all of a sudden my profession was gone, essentially. And my profession was like, you know, sitting there in a chair with one of those rubber bands, like doing little exercises to try to get some, to get my nerves to regrow in my legs. And that was basically how we started. And then we kind of got like 300 pages into it, and we were like, oh, this is a little more than we thought. And we actually then went and found a publisher in Patagonia Books. And, you know, it took us 3 years to put the whole book together, and it ended up being 464 pages. And I think to date we've sold around 60,000 copies, which is a lot more than the 200 we initially expected.
Yeah, it's really an incredible book. I mean, now two books, and I definitely want to talk more about that. But there's something that I want to throw back to what you just said in that story. And you know, you had a serious accident, and Scott, you mentioned having that accident in Alaska too. So I'm curious from the both of you, how you go about, I guess, you know, Steve, you mentioned sitting there with the rubber band trying to grow your nerves back, but what about like your mental nerves? How do you get your nerves back after that kind of an accident, something that serious, to then go and climb at a high level again? Personally, like the worst fall I had was just like a cliff or a rock broke while I was bouldering on some coastal cliffs in Monterey and smashed my leg. I had to get like 48 stitches. And that changed, you know, everything about how I look at rock and my comfortability and confidence on it for years, and still is in the back of my mind. And so there's a huge factor at play in terms of risk and I guess your nerves when you assess things and try to move on from situations like that. So I'm curious your perspective.
Yeah, that just reflects that you're smart. I think that if you aren't affected by those things, then there's something kind of wrong, for lack of a better word. You know, we need to, you know, that's the school of hard knocks way of learning. And I think if you don't, you know, have these experiences, get injured and don't reflect on why that happened and learn something from it, then you're going about something wrong. And you're probably not going to go too much longer without another one of these accidents. And we see people like that in the community that, you know, maybe people call them accident prones or whatever, but they seem to have an accident, not really reflect upon it, not really seem to learn from it. And I've known people like this pretty well, and I've tried to talk to them about this before. And some people just aren't capable of self-reflection in this way for some reason. And it doesn't usually end very well for them, frankly. It's really important to internalize the lessons that our own accidents, as well as the accidents of others, kind of can teach us. And otherwise, you know, I think that these sports, especially alpine climbing, but all forms of climbing and backcountry skiing as well, you know, they're very dangerous, and they kill people on a very regular basis. And if we're not fully cognizant of that, I think we're fooling ourselves in a way that makes it even more dangerous. So it's important to think about those things. And I would say for myself, you know, one of the things, and this relates back to why we're talking today, but, you know, I basically was laying on a ledge, feeling the blood fill up my chest cavity, and feeling my breath get shorter and shorter, knowing that if the helicopter didn't get there, that I was going to die. I had no injuries to my head. I had injuries to my chest wall and a broken pelvis. And I had a ton of internal injuries, internal bleeding from the broken ribs that had broken to the inside, and lacerated a bunch of organs in there. But I really had this thought, like, okay, well, if I die today, how do I feel about my life? Like, if this is it, what do you think? What's the scorecard? How did you do? And, you know, I remember that conversation to this day. And it's very clear to me, you know, one of the things I thought, well, if I, you know, I can be happy about my climbing career. I didn't do everything I wanted to do, but I did a lot of, things that I wanted to do. I'm really proud of what I accomplished in climbing. And I can feel good about that if I die today. But one of the things I hadn't done that I was really aware of is I hadn't done anything that helped others or helped my community or passed on information or become a teacher. I had been so solely focused on myself and my own climbing that it was just, I mean, I think that's what you have to do to be really good at something. You have to be incredibly selfish. And that's what I was. But I had not done other things. And so I think that the book with Training for the New Alpinism, as well as then Training for the New Alpinism spawned uphillathlete.com, which spawned Training for the Uphill Athlete, the newest book. And that all came out of this need to kind of say to the reaper someday, like, okay, I feel good about that. I did something for the rest of my community. I helped pass on good quality knowledge that people can want and can use and use for themselves and use it in a positive way. And, you know, I think that these accidents often become these sort of crucible moments in our lives where we have, and I know that this happened for Scott when his accident in Alaska, where you kind of makes you sit down and be like, okay, what I want to do. Like, you know, I'm clearly aware that I'm only here for a short time and I don't know how much longer that's going to be. So better make good use of it, kind of a thing. And, I think that, you know, I suspect your, fall in Monterey wasn't so different where, you know, it's kind of traumatic to have 48 stitches and get all cut up and you know, maybe it wasn't fatal, but still it made you probably think about, you mentioned that it made you look at things differently now. And, that's a good thing. And I think we should heed those lessons and grow out of those things.
That's massive. I love that. So such a dramatic moment. Of course, I mean, yours was ridiculous and I'm glad you came out of that. But you know, that realization of living selfish versus leaving impact. Right. So thank you for having that realization and for sharing the knowledge now and writing these books. I want to ask, just for our readers, like the difference between Training for the New Alpinism and Training for Uphill Athlete, like what, you know, which book should they read one before the other? Just give a general understanding for anybody who hasn't heard of them or hasn't picked them up yet of like what book is for what.
Okay. I'll chime in on this. As Steve sort of has told the story of how Training for the New Alpinism evolved, I mean, neither one of us, Steve had written more of a memoir than a book. This is Training for the New Alpinism is more like a textbook. So we were new to this kind of writing, and it was quite a challenge for us to get all our ideas down there in a way that people could absorb them. And I think we did a passable job. I liked the book. I think people have really enjoyed it and gotten a ton out of it. But you have to be a very engaged reader to really take away the message that I know we were trying to get across to folks about, you know, the theories behind training. And when shortly after that book came out, a young man, a Spanish man named Kilian Jornet, who at that time neither Steve nor I knew, put out on his Instagram that he had gotten a copy of the book and found it incredibly valuable and that he was recommending it to other mountain athletes like himself. And some of your audience may be familiar with Kilian, but he's the Steve House of the mountain running and ski mountaineering world. And so we made contact with Kilian after that. And during one of our conversations with him, he said, boy, I'd love to see a book like this for ski mountaineering and mountain running, but I don't want to write it. And so that got us thinking about this. Well, how could we repurpose Training for the New Alpinism? Because training for endurance sports, I mean, the basic and fundamental principles that are used for training for all endurance sports are the same. All we really did in Training for the New Alpinism and the Uphill Athlete book is repurpose conventional endurance training principles to these unconventional activities. We didn't invent anything new. We just sort of took a new look at it and came at it from a different angle. So we then stopped to write training for the uphill athlete. And I think the experience that we gained from writing training for the new alpinism, along with the several years of interacting with the public, gave us a much better handle on how to convey some of the complexities of training theory to people to make it a little more accessible. So I think the two books on their covers, and at first glance would appear to deal with, you know, almost entirely different subject matter. In fact, we knew this was happening. You know, most people who might be inclined to be interested in mountain running or ski mountaineering, they might pick up a book like Training for the New Alpinism. They look at the cover picture of Steve on this crazy climb in Peru and go, oh my God, I don't do that kind of thing. And then put the book down immediately without understanding that there's this commonality in training methodologies and training principles that applies across this really broad spectrum of sports. And so what we hoped with to reach a different audience with, and so not have a picture of Steve doing something that looks really crazy and scary on the front cover, we put a picture of actually Killian running, doing something that looks crazy and scary on the front cover of that book. I think it's, so the big difference isn't so much in the real meat of the material. Certainly the application is different. I mean, there's certain things that you would do for training for climbing that you don't do when you're training for running. But the general principles are very, very similar. And I think that most people will find training for the uphill athlete more accessible. And that came about because of our experience in dealing with the general public. Again, as Steve and I, we did not think we would sell 1,000 copies of Training for the New Alpinism. And so we thought we would write that book and then go on with the rest of our lives. But after the book came out, we were just overwhelmed with requests for more training information and even people wanted coaching. And out of that grew the uphill athlete business that we have, which is based out of uphillathlete.com. And we've tried to give a lot of free information there. We do offer coaching services, but it's primarily a place where people can go to get good, solid information about training. And it's information that either needed, the articles that are on there perhaps expand upon or take a different tack than we could have taken in the book with certain ideas. We also have a forum where people can come on and ask questions. And Steve and myself and one other fellow moderate that forum. So we're on it virtually daily answering people's questions. But during this process of having to explain some of these ideas to people over several years and literally thousands and thousands of people, we got much, much better at it than I think that we were on the first writing.
So one of the things, and maybe you get this question in some of the Q&As that you guys do about the books, but there is so much science, and Jonathan and I both obviously have the Uphill Athlete. He has New Alpinism, taking a look at that too. But there's so much science, and it's definitely dense, right? So maybe some of the things that when you were researching or learning over this whole process of, I think now almost 20 years of starting to train, from starting to train Steve all the way till now, what are the things that really surprise you the most, or maybe are myth busting almost around endurance training or just the physiology of endurance?
Well, that's probably a deep subject. In fact, we just spent, almost 800 pages talking about it. So it's a little hard to
We can't
do that justice here today, but I would say that, the thing that happened during my evolution as an athlete and then morphing into a coach was I was very curious, like, why are we training this way? What were we doing these types of workouts for, and why were they in this order and that sort of thing? And sometimes I got decent answers. I was luckily exposed to some fairly high level coaching, and generally I was able to find answers, but a lot of times I wasn't, and I would go digging and looking outside the sports I was involved in, looking outside swimming, looking outside cross-country skiing, looking to other sports to see how they did some of these things and why they did it. And finding cross-country skiing, especially in this country, is not a very heavily studied sport. And as a consequence, when I began to coach, I started looking very hard at how athletes in much more a more conventional sport like running, which isn't too dissimilar in many ways from cross-country skiing, how they trained, because that's a very well-studied sport. You know, literally millions of athlete guinea pigs for the last 100 years, with tens of thousands of coaches trying all these different ideas. After a while, the good stuff's going to float to the top. And that sort of evolutionary process of trial and error refinement has brought I would hesitate to call it a science of training for endurance sports, because it was basically trial and error. And while science can explain some of or most of the concepts and most of the ideas, we have enough of an understanding these days of physiology and genetics, and that sort of thing, we can say, oh, this is why that type of training works well. But oftentimes when the coaches that came up with some of these ideas, they may not have had any clue of why this stuff worked. They just saw that when they tried this with these athletes, those athletes got better. Or on the opposite end of things, they tried this and, ooh, that doesn't work very well. We're either going to abandon that idea or we're going to modify it. You know, over decades and decades, that evolutionary process resulted in a pretty well-defined model of how endurance training works. And so that system is, we try to explain that system and what it's based upon and the science behind it, so that people can understand there is an intellectual framework that supports these principles that we're talking about here. These are not something we just dreamed up and or that, you know, have no basis of support. So that's one of the reasons that we go into some depth with the physiology, is so that people can see, because we feel these are type A personalities generally that are reading these books. They're going to be curious. They're going to want to know, like, why is it you say that and other people say this? And so we want to back up our claims. And certainly, again, we did not invent any of this stuff. We are just repurposing a tried and true method that has been used for decades on these athletes. And probably there's a couple of principal misunderstandings, I would say, in the general public about training for endurance. And the first one that we need to get right out in the open that we start in our books with is there's a difference between training and exercise. And what most people do, and I would include myself in that these days, because I'm 65 years old, I'm no longer anything like an athlete. But what most people do is just sort of randomized exercise. They go out and do what they feel like on any given day, and maybe it's ride a bike, maybe it's go climbing, maybe it's whatever. And some of them do it a lot. And you can become very fit with a high level of random exercise. But we want to make the distinction between this sort of random approach to lots and lots of exercise and actual training. Because what training is a systematized approach where you're here at point A on date A, and on date B out there in the future, you want to be somewhere else. You want to be a different type of athlete. You want to perform a certain goal project, a goal event that you're training for. And between A and B, you have a structured plan that contains three principal components that are really critical to training. These are components that don't exist in randomized training. And one of them is continuity. In other words, the training can't have major breaks in it. The other one is the training load needs to progress gradually over time, because as your body adapts to a certain training load, you need to increase the training stimulus in order to get additional training effects. So there needs to be a built-in progressivity, and that's something that's usually really lacking in most people's random approach. You know, they just go out and do whatever on any given day and don't bother to think about how this is going to progress on the long term. And then finally, the third component that has to exist in a good training plan is what's called modulation, where there's hard days and easy days and hard weeks and easy weeks, so that during the easy period is when your body can adapt to whatever the previous training load was. So those are some of the principles that we try to explain to people as, you know, very basic ideas of how to train. And I would say the other big misconception that we've battled now for many years, and is that this concept or this notion on the part of the general public that somehow you can substitute intensity for duration when it comes to endurance training. That if you don't have, you can't run 100 miles a week because you don't have, you know, you don't have the legs for it, or you don't have the time for it. You've got to pick the kids up after school and take them to soccer practice, and you can only run for 30 minutes. That you can somehow just run harder during those 30 minutes and get the same effect as somebody who might be out there running for an hour or 2 hours. And we spell that with the physiological background that we give in the book and explain why, while intensity is an important part of endurance training, it's not a substitution for duration, it's a supplement to duration. And that's a concept that I think the modern fitness industry has really muddied the waters on here. And you know, they're trying to sell snake oil. They're trying to tell people, oh, you just, you know, do this for 30 minutes as hard as you can, and you're going to get the same benefits. And while that is certainly true, perhaps from just the average non-athlete, that's not true as an athlete. If you're an athlete and you have endurance training goals, then you need to understand why that doesn't apply to you. Sorry, I can go down a really deep rabbit hole with this stuff, so I'm going to back off right now.
No, I really like that rabbit hole. Yeah, seriously. It's a great hole.
I think Jonathan and I are both in a place where in a couple of weeks we're doing larger endurance objectives, so this could not come at a better time for us.
Yeah, right? Which we can get to in a second, actually. Yeah. But I do want to say, I know you're you know, spot on about uphill athlete being a little more approachable, easy to digest. I know that New Alpinism way more like a textbook, whereas the uphill athlete has a lot more of the stories to kind of carry the information. But I will say both of them sit right beside Freedom of the Hills on my shelf. So that's kind of like my like Bibles for the outdoors these days. But for working with Killian on this latest book, I'm curious your perspective about the ceiling of an individual athlete. Like how much of it is just basically innate, you know, physiological ability that somebody naturally has an advantage over other people? Or like, does it really in your mind come down to the proper training, and then there's limitless potential for somebody?
Well, I think that could be summed up in a really clever saying that is really common with running coaches, and that is that sprinters are born, distance runners are made. And so for endurance sports, Killian is a unique creature, and I'm sure genetically gifted, but he's also got this enormous training background. And so while it might not be possible to be, you know, a Killian Jornet, or it might not be possible to, you know, stand on a world championship podium, you can achieve an incredibly high level with just perseverance. Whereas you're never going to break 10 seconds in the 100-meter dash if you didn't come out with a special gift. There's just no way that that's ever going to happen. Or you're never going to be able to high jump, you know, 2 meters if you didn't have these really special, unique gifts. Because humans are predisposed for endurance. That is what got us, evolved us to the highest state that we were, was our ability to endure and to run down other animals and that sort of thing as hunter-gatherers. We're not a very particularly powerful or strong species. And so when we see a Usain Bolt or someone who can do these amazing athletic things, it's always really striking for us because that's so far outside the norm of human experience. Whereas, you know, like people don't recreationally high jump, but people recreationally hike and run and do long runs and that sort of thing, because that's where we are. You know, we're sort of naturally endowed in that direction. So I think it's unwise. First of all, it's unwise to compare yourself to a world champion. That's always a bad idea, because there's perhaps, like I said, some special gifts, but there's also, I mean, Killian's got a 25-year training history of, you know, and started, he was training over 1,000 hours a year by the time he was, you know, in his early teens. So that sort of background could completely overshadow any sort of genetic gift that he came out of the box with. But I also think it's unwise to try to copy what those people do. In fact, we go to some lengths in the new book on the Uphill Athlete book of cautioning people, don't try to do what Killian does. And in fact, if you notice in the book, we make a point of not talking about what Killian's training looks like. And that was something that we consciously decided during the course of writing the book was, this book isn't written for world champions, or, you know, it's written for the everyday amateur athlete who wants to have access to the kind of information that a world champion athlete has. So it's really written at that, like I said, the amateur weekend warrior type folks who are still looking to excel and maximize their own potential. But because we figure that in the professional level athletes, they have coaches or by at some point in their career, they've figured out what works for them. And they, you know, they might want to pick our book up and read it out of curiosity, but that isn't really our, the audience that we tried to write it for.
Okay, I know you want to keep listening to this interview. It's fantastic. They're dropping a lot of value, and it's really a great conversation, but we are going to stop it here. Before we get into really asking some candid advice from Stephen Scott around around Emily's big run and around my big climb, and get their advice, and then also Emily and I are going to kind of recap on actually what happened on those adventures for us next week. So thank you for tuning in to part one of this conversation with Steve House and Scott Johnston from Training for the Uphill Athlete, the Uphill Athlete Coaches.